time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And tonight, we will be discussing the eighth episode of USA's Colony. This one is called In From the Cold.
And this one has to go out to our Twitter friend, John Baker. Thanks, John, for your well wishes.
There yeah. You have it, John. Proof that the sassier half's voice is still in dry dock this afternoon.
I'm trying my best, John.
Caroline had a question while we watched this. What in the world does In From the Cold mean? And I can't say that I know from my own personal life, except for having watched other movies. It's a phrase that relates to informing or coming to the authority figure, whatever that is, an intelligence group or agency, government, whatever, with information that will help them with an investigation.
So it's like the opposite of like being on the lam. It's like you're coming in from the cold.
Right. The cold is...
The cold is the lamb, if you will.
Yes. And it, in yeah. is on the side of who's ever in charge.
Thank God you watch all these other movies. I would never know that stuff.
Gotta do what I gotta do. Stay up on this kind of terminology.
You really do. For the day you have to become a spy. Which, B, you don't know. Clearly, if Colony teaches us anything here, baby, it's that it could be any time. We don't know when the arrival's going to be.
I only hope I could play it as cool as our characters, or not. This episode starts in an unfamiliar setting. This one having people in hazmat suits tending to large tanks filled with who knows what inside.
I think it's the human spirit.
You think it's like liquefied human spirit?
I don't know. Spirit in whatever form. Spirit. What is spirit? Spirit's like gaseous. I don't know what state it is. So not liquid, right?
I'd figure gaseous.
I think gaseous is right. So no, I think it's gaseous human spirit, Paul.
Okay. Just put that like on the side of the truck.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Hazard human spirit inside.
The shift tending to the tanks appears to be over, and we notice a familiar face in a hazmat suit walking away. He looks like Carlos to me.
Oh my goodness. Can I just say that Carlos was having a great air day. I mean, a great air day. He looks super handsome. I think that hazmat suit is really agreeing with him.
Oh, well.
And whatever's going on, I assume this is the factory. Honestly, I assume that's what
this
is.
Well, we knew that that's where he was heading.
And here he is. So vis-a-vis, it's the factory.
I would guess so.
For sure.
Next scene is he's at a very sad looking cafetorium with his workmates. No one is talking. No one is looking at each other.
But I wrote here that his hair got nasty by dinner time.
So it's whatever. Important that we chronicle all the details.
Well, really, honestly, here's a little tip that you guys need to know. I'm very into my hair. And so sometimes I'll just like look over and be like, my hair looks good today. And then my loving husband will do this noise with his chest and go chopper copter 5 here with the hair report. So just so you know, I'm going to be in on the hair report tonight. Because honestly, I'd be curious to find out if they have like a new hair and makeup person tonight. Because I noticed everybody's hair and makeup.
At this lunch, one of our coworkers starts to just harmlessly cough up a little blood. And you'd think that he had the plague with the reaction that he got.
Dude, I think he did have the plague. I felt like everyone was doing their very best. Just don't look at him or you're going to barf up your own dinner. So just like be cool, play it cool.
The goon squad shows up and escorts him away. And he's pleading for, no, this isn't what you think. This is just, you know.
He was trying to say he had like a tickle in his throat. Like, yeah, it's just a little something stuck in my throat. And it's like, dude, you just bled out your esophagus onto the dinner plate. Do you think this is one of those, like, we can't have illness in close quarters? So we're going to lose all our workers if we have like one sick one? Or is this more like, this is some sort of effect that happens from working out at the factory? They're wearing hazmat suits. I assume there's some sort of contaminant kind of crap in there.
We've watched too many zombie shows, so my first thoughts are always going to be like, well, any sign of sickness means contagion, means you're toast, means you have to be away from the group. But this isn't a zombie show, so there's no reason to think that. I do think it has more to do with whatever it is that they underwent to make them suitable for living and working at the factory. Maybe it's got a shelf life, and once you're used up, you go downhill too fast to care for, so you're just done. If you notice, that cafeteria only had a single table. And Proxy Snyder's been,
People at the factory,
pretty generous with the factory appointments lately.
Yikes.
So, maybe they wear out really fast.
Do you think also maybe the materials that they're handling is harmful to human beings? Like, it kind of, like, they're using us like tissues?
Well, if it is like liquid human soul, how can it be that bad? Gaseous human soul.
Well, maybe whatever they have to use to like store us.
Human soul tongs.
Like formaldehyde's bad for humans, right?
True.
Because like a preservative, right? So maybe whatever they use to preserve our spirit. I don't think they're preserving it I think it's like I told you already about the Monsters, Inc. It's like they're using our laughs for power. Like maybe they're stealing our human spirits. I'm sick.
Final shot of the introduction is in the dorm room where Carlos is staring longingly out a window and his roommate buddy is telling him to knock it off because he makes him feel bad.
He doesn't like that longful staring at home, you jerk.
And the camera pans around and we see from out the window, Carlos is looking at the Earth.
Freaky. Did you expect that?
No.
Me neither.
So the moon is also where the factory is.
That's what we're concluding.
Well, that'd be a heck of a mislead.
It could have just been like a space station whirling around.
Could have been. Okay, so the factory is space-borne, at least.
Could be, yeah. I just put outer space.
Next morning at the Bowman's breakfast table, things are off to a nice chipper start.
Shit, it's a little icy. That's a bad day, the way that the Katie Will dynamic is starting.
Yeah, she's basically like, stop looking at me.
So I'm not a morning person at all, and I've absolutely definitely said, stop looking at me in the morning. I'm like, who's breathing like that? Stop it. Stop breathing like that.
That's true.
But I wrote down on the paper, Katie's picking. Picking for a fight. Picking.
And Will makes a bold, unauthorized move here. He decides to tell the kids that they know where Charlie is.
Well, crap. I mean, come on. What is this? P, if you pulled this on me, I would have not allowed you to continue talking. I'd have been like, stop.
Well,
stop.
See, the thing is, Will held a parental emergency meeting the night before, I think, but he didn't send out all the invitations. He just went himself. Figured that a quorum had attended, and he decided to make unilateral family decisions in light of what he now knows about Katie's loss of voting privileges in the parental unit of the family.
See, I think this was just a snot thing that you do so that he can use the line, we don't keep secrets in this family. Even if he's like, everyone, I have an announcement. We are out of bacon. And she's like, why'd you tell them? I'd be like, we don't keep secrets in this family. Like, it's just like a reason.
Oh, so
to
he
say
just
it.
Swung for the fence with the first shot, huh?
If you decided to pull our other children out and say, hey, listen, I'm going to give you some information about your beloved brother who is like completely being held in an evil situation. And you just like shared that. Like, I never would have allowed you to share the photo. Because that photo was sad and horrible.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think Will might think that she's on probation at best.
I get it. And you know what? She should be. Well, Bram, he wants more information. He's like, where is this? Where's he living?
And
what's
the
situation?
And he thinks it's kind of chicken shit that Will doesn't have it and can't get it.
I would like to say, though, good hair for Bram, good hair for Will. I said, good hair all around for the menfolk. Everybody's hair looks delightful.
Well, I'll have to get their number then.
You do that.
After Bram storms out, Katie pulls Will to the side out in the hallway and says that she should have had a discussion about when to reveal all this. And that's when Will says, no secrets in our house.
Well, what would we do? Would we tell or would we keep it to ourselves?
Until we were much closer, I think that we would not tell.
We would definitely not tell because it's crap to tell kids stuff like this. I mean, this is a adult situation that has to be dealt with, and it's very sad and scary.
And our particular kids would ask us every single day, where's Charlie?
Hell yeah. Every day. That's very kind. It would be like, we would be like finishing the sentence, like, and that's where Charlie is. And they'd be like, where's Charlie? You'd be like, I just finished saying where Charlie was.
On those days when you were farther away from Charlie than you were the day before, which can happen in this world, that would feel even worse.
I think it's crappy. You know, I've been team Will over team Katie this whole time, but don't use kids as pawns. The end. Don't use sex as a weapon. Don't use kids as pawns.
She believes that this merits a lot of discussion, and he's like, I got to go to work, non-voting partner.
Right. He's like, peace. The polling booths have closed.
Snyder gets to work, and he sees a surprise guest waiting in his office for him. Helena, from corporate or wherever she comes from.
We'll just call it corporate. That's fine.
Is waiting in his office for him. She's got some big news.
Spin doctoring or not, boys. I really liked the way that Alan handled all of her remarks. It would have been extremely easy to get himself wound up right in front of her, you know? So when she says things like, it's the anniversary of the arrival, and he's like, you know, are we going to have a celebration? You know, like, I like it that he's like hopeful still, you know? And she says, no, a little more like a performance review. And he says the best thing ever. I'm going to try to start saying crap like this. When someone says like, you know what, we're going to need to look at this. I'm going to be like, I welcome us looking at that. I'm going to start saying that to you. We're going to like, you're like, the credit card bill's here. We're going to need to talk about this. I welcome us talking about the bills.
Yeah, I'll really be thrown off. Helena has a few interesting things to say before she heads out. This is very interesting because anytime you have a story that takes place in the future, at least let's say from a Western pop culture / literary perspective, anytime you have a story that takes place in the future that depicts an entire society, there are inevitable comparisons to be made to either 1984 and or Brave New World. It's not even that clever on my part because she mentions George Orwell from the get-go,
but
when she says, what do the people in your block fear to do, or whatever she says, that's the point of what she says. That is the whole idea of the dystopian government in 1984, is making everybody fear to do anything.
I put an article on Daily Review on our Facebook page that compares Brave New World to 1984, and they do handle how to oppress people in different ways. So if you're interested, go take a look and read it. But I can give you the quick version, which is in one society, they utilize fear to oppress the people and taking things away from them. And in the other one, I feel like that they affect their senses more. So they do things that make them docile. So they give them a medication called Soma. They encourage them to have casual sex. It's all about sort of keeping them in this very docile kind of state, where the other one, it's more like you're terrorized, like you're completely fearful all the time. And so you do what they tell you to do. In that world, you are not allowed to have sex and you are not allowed to basically think for yourself or do anything. So they handle oppression in very different ways. And I feel like it's a lot of what's happening in our colony world here. Proxy Snyder is trying to speak towards if we can have recreation, if there's a quality of life. Basically, the people will stay docile. They will stay calm. They will be happy with their lives so that they won't need to push back. Helena is basically like, nobody's doing it this way. And nobody's afraid of you or afraid of doing stuff in this block, which is funny because he is saying the same thing. He is saying, I know, because I'm not using fear. So her retort of saying like, well, no one's scared here is like, Mm-hmm. Because we're not using fear as the tactic of keeping everybody happy and cool. Or I should just say cool. We're not doing anything mean to anybody. And he was saying, you know, that order doesn't come from fear. But she uses the quote, the Orwell quote, imagine a boot stomping on a human face forever. That's basically the vision of the future, right?
Yeah.
I looked it up and there's lots to read about it. But basically, if you just think about it in terms of power and having absolute power, and really historically throughout time, somebody's boot was on someone else's face. And that's why the one with the boot got to rule and say what they wanted to happen. And the one getting stomped on had to just follow orders. And so that, unfortunately, and it, like, I'm a kind of person who, like, cringes when I hear quotes like that, because I hate the idea of anybody getting hurt, and especially something like that. She didn't say, imagine houses being blown up or something. Like, this is close contact.
Like a visceral sense of your submission or being forced to submit.
And
to,
you're still, and you're alive, you know, you're alive and you're aware and someone's...
It reminds me of, remember in Lincoln, they were showing that one battle. They only showed really one battle close up. I don't remember what it was, but in order to kill the other guy, one soldier had to stomp his face into just a puddle.
Yeah. Because he was, like, out of ammunition, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and it just had become like a fist fight, basically. And yeah, yes, he just had to stomp him.
And the idea of getting drowned in a puddle was just too real to me, you know? And so that, for some reason, that visual is what came to mind when she mentioned the boot on the face.
And she, my God, she's a put together woman, man, talking about stomping people's faces. She's a freaking scary human to have around in the world. She doesn't have any problem talking about any of this. She's well beyond someone who's just going along with the authority. We haven't actually met someone like her, because Phyllis wasn't like her. Beau's not like her. Jennifer, while she hasn't said anything, she's not about, like, smacking people around or whatever, you know? She wants people to follow in line, but she's not hurting anyone.
Having just binged a bunch of Sons of Anarchy, and Allie Walker is also a government goon in Sons of Anarchy, I was not surprised to see that maybe they liked her work in Sons of Anarchy, because that person was highly dishonest and amoral and all that, but still had this kind of swagger and used her badge in this way that this character agrees with, I would say.
Swagger is exactly the right word. I was going to say it far less eloquently and say, like, she gets off on saying nasty stuff like that. Like, she's...
That's because you're dirty.
She's one of those people who just... Like, she's like, yeah, and grind the heel on the nose, you know? Like, she's just nasty like that.
If she rattles Proxy Snyder, he doesn't give her the satisfaction.
Oh, Paul, if she rattles, yeah, she absolutely is gonna weigh on him now, because
we know from later that he that's true. But from this scene,
it wouldn't matter. It absolutely wouldn't matter. Like, have somebody come down from corporate and stand there and tell you about boots on humans' faces. You don't leave like da 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 da. See you later. I mean, you're sitting there like, ugh, and that bead of sweat starts like going down your spine. Like, oh my God.
I thought he played that scene rather cool.
I thought he did great. I mean, I said, like, his responses were great. I'm going to start using that. I welcome this conversation. Like, I think it was handled very well, but there's no way that he felt anything other than despair is the word I would use.
See, I see Proxy Snyder sticking around for a long time on this show. Even if he were to fall out of power and be on the run and blah, 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 he may still be the only person who knows how to traverse the world and get back to Charlie if it came to that. So even if he was drummed out, it might still be in Will's interest to save him.
They've paired them up, you know, this entire season. Now that we know there's season two for certainty, every show's got to have a little corral of people who can come out and be good and can also be the ones that cause a lot of trouble for you too. You know, you've got to have your Kimmy Gibblers, if you will.
Someone's been binging the Fuller House release.
With the small children. But, and I'm not comparing Snyder to Kimmy Gibbler. I'm just saying that you always have to have.
That's like an epic rap battle waiting to happen. Right?
You just always have to have somebody. You have to have the antagonist at a level that isn't the worst level. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, no. They're much more interesting when.
Yeah, when they can kind of go back and forth and there's a little bit of something there.
Katie has called for a meeting at what looks like the remains of Silver Lake Metal Shop with Rachel. She brings her teenage boys in tow to stand guard while she and Katie get down to business.
So this was interesting. I thought this was like a pretty big reversal, really, because Rachel had always been her...
like template, I thought.
Yeah, or like, and I hesitate to use the word mentor because that's too kind or too nurturing. Like Rachel was always around to be like, this is the way it is, and that kind of thing. But so for Katie then to be sitting there and being like, I want out, this is the way it is, I've got to do this. And Rachel kind of being the one who had to be more quiet and had to kind of listen to this, very new.
Katie does want out, and Rachel sees her side of it without a whole lot of explanation. It's a kind of a mother-to-mother connection.
Well, what did you think about the idea that Rachel had her boys... and like lookout, like not just like they were around or that they knew she was in the resistance, like she has them actively in the line of fire. I mean,
I think she got it right when she described herself as a shitty parent.
Me too. What would we do if we were both actively in the resistance? Wouldn't we come home and put on, like, you'd put on your Ward Cleaver face and I'd be like, welcome home for dinner, honey. And like, I don't feel like we would ever,
you know,
put our kids in the way.
After 8 episodes of this show and the whole collaborate or resist, you know, motif of the marketing behind the show, at this point, resistance just does not have any appeal to me. You know,
right?
They're the ones that are getting killed, not getting any medicine for their sick kids. They're a bunch of whiners when it comes down to.
Well, even if we were on that side of the fight, I could see us being very good at the marketplace and getting what we needed and trading the things and being very effective pushing on the rules. But I don't see us like setting up situations where people are getting killed or... that kind of stuff. Like we would just be trying to make the absolute best of it and really honestly protecting as many people as we could.
And Katie is tired of those hurt people kind of getting too close to her. So she says she wants out. Rachel says, you know what? I will go to Quayle on your behalf. And if he says anything like not letting you out, then I say I'm out too. So I guess it's like a suffragette sister sort of situation.
I guess. I guess at this point, the cell is like 5 people. So, I mean, I guess if they, I mean, you know, Rachel would pull her boys, obviously. So they'd have very few people left.
Little does Rachel know what's about to go down.
Yeah. So Bo and Will are back at the office and Bo is going through files.
I think it's really interesting how Will has taken the what used to be the boss's office and turned it into his team's office and kind of research area. Because Bo is just in there tearing the place apart with pictures and books and all kinds of junk everywhere. And so the idea of step into my office, that's kind of disappeared under
you're right.
Will's leadership.
You're absolutely right. He absolutely brought in Jennifer and Bo. Weirdly, no one else. Everybody else just like, I don't know, their desks are just empty out there. But there's no one else around, really. And he does welcome them into everything.
Bo is looking into Broussard's history, finds out that he was a 3-year starter, a linebacker. I'm assuming that's in college. And his senior quote was Nietzsche. If you don't know Nietzsche, he's a philosopher who did not stand with a lot of others in his appraisal of how people should think about how they should act. I looked up what might be some relevant information about him, and it seemed to boil down to that everybody needs to decide how they're going to act and value and consider right and wrong all on their own. They need to decide that for themselves, and they shouldn't do that under the influence of the moral code of those around them, the society they live in, or even any kind of religious influence. It's up to you how you act.
we always relate these things back to our own family and upbringing. And for certainty, this is the way I was brought up. And in fact, in our own household, I can say that how many times I've said, don't let that person's behavior affect yours. In terms of like, so you weren't invited to something, that doesn't matter. You still invite them. They don't determine how you behave. Or if someone's snotty to you, you don't act nasty back to them. You decide who are you? How do you behave? And no matter the circumstances, you be you and don't let other people dictate. And I think when we think about like not going with like modern society or whatever, in many ways that might make you think, oh, wow, you're really like an outlier, or like you're a deviant or something like that. But when I think of it now, these days, it's more like if you are trying to just maintain a good moral compass and you're trying to stick to what you know is good for your family and what's right for your family, that type of thing. I know a lot of people that homeschool or a lot of people that do different things, make different choices that I would in no way consider them to be outliers. But it was like, this is what's the right path for my family.
How that corresponds to Broussard is kind of amped up. He is applying what he believes to be values worth fighting for.
I'll go with values worth fighting for.
On a lethal level with those around him. He knows that he's right, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to defend that. And that's how I viewed that connection there when Beau brought it up. Phone rings, and this is when Quayle delivers that the leak is your wife. You want to chat?
This is all playing out so differently than I guess I thought it would. And it's far more complicated, sophisticated, and interesting than I thought. I wasn't giving the show, when we first heard the premise, I wasn't giving it enough credit that there is like a longer, more complicated way it could play out. Because it was always sort of like, well, she's just hiding it from him. And boy, is he going to be mad when he finds out.
Yeah.
Like that's as far as I had like thought it through. And so then when it was like, oh man, people have been telling Will it's his wife for many episodes now. And he is playing this like so differently. I don't know, Paul, maybe that says something about you. So all I can think is, boy, he's going to be so mad.
No, I didn't quite see this coming the way that it works out in this episode. He tells him to meet on a bus, a very crowded public place, and that is where they meet. Will sits down next to Quayle, and after exchanging a few pleasantries, I guess, he admits that he runs Katie's cell and will give up Broussard for certain terms. And unless those terms are met, under interrogation, the first name that he will give up is Katie's name. And the terms are he wants a truck and a pass to leave the wall.
I liked a lot of the subtle interactions that happened in this exchange. So when Will decides he's got to like try to keep it cool about the phone ringing, he's like staring at the phone and Beau's like, what's up? And he's like, that phone's never rang before. like that kind of stuff. It was funny because we haven't heard a phone ring, you know, so that kind of thing was like, that was funny. And I liked when Will was all, you know, I don't want to waste your time. You don't need to come. And Beau's like, I sure as hell wouldn't worry about that. Like, Beau, you're so cute. And I liked the whole thing when he got on and he's like, how's the gardening going? To Quayle. There was a lot of small little details there that I thought were really good banter. I appreciate between characters. I definitely felt like Will's situation, like his head's going to explode here because the way that early on Katie had stuff going on and he was always giving her that wide-eyed look, like where he'd always be like, Katie, what's the matter? And he wouldn't say anything. I feel like what we're getting in this episode and kind of started the last one, he's clamming up too. And like he's starting to have a lot on his mind and trying to layer all these people. Like now he's got Quayle and he's got Snyder, you know.
Getting onto a bus and needing to talk to this stranger about stuff that he knows that your wife has been up to behind your back has got to be, you know, on one level that, I mean, if that stuff was just, you know, she was putting together a scrapbook for me and I found out by mistake, that's one thing. But the fact that she's been working to undermine me and the stuff she's been doing might have gotten me killed at some point, that's kind of an extra layer on there. And this is the guy that knows all about it.
See, I agree with you, but I think it's also that my spouse has been having private conversations with this other man, and that is really uncomfortable. I mean, it's going to be Quayle's undoing later. Like, the more you tell me what my wife is like, and the more you tell me what my wife's capable of, the more I hate you, right?
I think so.
Because it doesn't even matter. We're watching 112263 on Hulu right now, and the more that old Clayton and
Jake slash George
have a conversation about the same woman and say, oh yeah, well, she's like this, she's like, it makes you just want to like strangle the other guy, right? Like, you don't talk about my woman, what she's like.
It is like that. And I think there's a lot of that in Will.
Oh my God. Yeah. To me, that stinks of she's had some emotional affair or something, because that means...
Oh, like it's an old wound.
Mm-hmm.
Rubbing up
against some other situation where some man appears to have known more about what my wife is going through or feeling or whatever than I do. And that is always going to chap his dupe.
The one who might have been chapping that dupe is in the next scene, taking place at the spy meeting place, Echo Park. Broussard meets a British guy who has some information that he wanted to bring him. The British guy misunderstands things the same as Broussard used to. He heard that Broussard was Geronimo's tactical arm. Isn't that interesting that this is another uninformed person on the nature of Geronimo?
I loved this guy because he like called it out straight away, the same way that we have, like where he's like, why are we meeting in a park? This seems conspicuous. Why would we meet here? This seems weird. Like, your cell's lame. What are y'all doing over here? I was like, yay.
Yeah, it was funny.
But I also would like to say that both Broussard and this new man, holy smokes, they both look like models. Their makeup was like freaking perfect. Perfect. Their hair was perfect. Everything looked perfect.
The lowdown outside of their aesthetic qualities is that the guy knows that the chief minister is coming in town and they want to make a hit. And they were fans of the way things went down with Proxy Snyder. So they think that if anyone has a shot, it's got to be Broussard.
Meanwhile, out on a taco run, Bo and Will are going to need to chat because Will's got a coolie, and I mean smooth operator coolie, got to bring Bo up to speed here on a lot of the shenanigans.
He doesn't say exactly directly.
Well, he never says the name Katie.
Right.
But
he's developed his relationship with Bo to the point where he believes that Bo will read between the lines, and Bo does.
Mm-hmm.
He believes that he is the source of the leak, and then he gives a dimple smile. And Bo pretty well sees what he means by that by the time he's done explaining.
I like when he's like, interesting theory.
Yes.
I think Will talks right now like they're bugged, like that he just assumes everyone's listening all the time. Having just said that out loud, the authority phones would absolutely be bugged. So the fact that Quayle called in and said, it's your wife, somebody else knows it's his wife now. Because
maybe yes, maybe no. In like a 1984 type situation, yes, they would know instantaneously. In a how things work like right now kind of situation,
sure.
Someone has to be knowing to look, sitting and waiting for that phone to ring, and then they listen. Rather than someone is always listening to every phone all the time.
I don't know. Then how can we have Bronson Construction and my porch is falling down and blah, 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 blah. Do you think it's just like, do you think Phyllis's line was always like a confidential, nobody listens in line?
No, I don't believe that
exists.
Is a thing.
Well,
no.
So then do you get what I'm saying about the like, it's, I get it that he's being very cautious in the way he's speaking to Bo, because I do feel like there's a sense that somebody's always watching. But then arg about that phone call, right?
Well, we haven't been super right about someone always watching with the consistency that we think that there would be given the level of technology displayed. I mean, if they have these floating drone things,
then a
voice
phone
recognition
bug is
or
no
whatever
big deal.
Has got to, seems way beneath what they're at.
Right, right. I mean, now, I mean, hello, the operator back in the day could just listen in on your lines, you know? It's not even technology.
The point of Bo and Will's discussion is that if they bring in Quail, he's afraid that he's going to give up Katie, even if they go through with this deal thing. So he believes that it can be done where they can set up Broussard to want to kill Quail and even set up the occasion for him to do it. With the gentleman's understanding between them, Will and Beau head to Proxy Snyder's office to deliver the news that Quail has made contact and he wants a deal. Will frames it in the slightly altered version of reality by saying that Quail, a low-level operative from Broussard's organization, has contacted them and will spill some beans in exchange for a deal.
To sort of understand where Snyder's head is right now, we know that earlier Helena had come in and given him a lot of grief about having the visitor coming from, what was the name of it?
His chief minister.
Chief
something.
Minister. And when he greets them, he says, "Uneasy is the head that wears the crown." And I knew that came from Shakespeare, but I didn't know that much about it. I checked it out and it came from Henry IV. Generally, what you need to understand is that this was a line that was used to express how tired and guilty and sick and overwhelmed with the rebellion that King Henry was feeling. He felt a lot of burden of the power that he had. And the way that Shakespeare portrayed him was that he was very fearful that history would repeat itself. He felt a lot of pressure to rule, and he was really feeling like he didn't like basically the pressure and everything. There was a lot of burden on him. So I thought that was a great line, because we had said last episode that when they brought in the Ingrid Bergman home and how much guilt that she felt during the World War II time frame, it put me into the mind frame that, okay, this is supposed to be showing us how Snyder's feeling. So then for him to quote another character feeling guilty and tired and overwhelmed and everything, I feel like they're doing a great job of, even though Snyder, the character, is saying things like, "Oh, I welcome progress
reviews
and we're doing great and that kind of stuff," but they are having him quote characters or live in a home of people who were overwhelmed with grief and guilt. And yeah. So what a clever way to let us know more about our character.
Good insight. But he's ready for Will's report here and wants to know what deal could possibly be of interest. This is a man who works with Broussard. Broussard is the person that Snyder has identified as chief in charge of trying to kill him recently.
Right.
So anyone involved in that plan deserves harsh punishment.
Right, exactly. Nothing good.
When Will tells him that all he wants is a pass outside the wall and a pickup truck to get him there, Snyder gets a smile on his face that I read as, "I wanted a death sentence, and he's asking for a death sentence, so sure, why not?"
It all works out. In any which way, he's out of here.
One snag to the plan is that before this all goes down, Snyder wants to look at this guy in the eye and see what he's dealing with, see who would be plotting against him. So he wants to meet Quail before anything is agreed to.
Poor Will, he's like, "Ugh, great."
This is a snag that could go sideways on him if the guy just says, "Katie's in my group."
Yeah, absolutely. You could blurt out anything. It's very dangerous.
But what can he do except for agree to go along with it? It's his boss, so he does. Quail and Broussard meet in an industrial area.
Quail is so sassy. He's all, "Your house looks like a Red Hat convention. I wonder who told them where that house is."
Quail, who in the original episodes seemed like a curmudgeon who just needed to say as little as possible and just kind of make faces and sneer at people.
He's definitely in the "I'm too old for this shit" boat.
And he is now not only chatty, but he's turned into someone that...
He's like a nudge.
Yeah, he just picks and picks and picks, and he spends a lot of his time picking at an individual who's a pretty dangerous guy to pick at, I would think.
Seems it.
Broussard broaches the subject of Geronimo. "Why did you lie to me about Geronimo?" And Quail's answer was, "If I was Broussard, less than satisfying." He says, "I thought you would have figured out that that was a lie. Just for the people, just for the sheep out there." If I was Broussard, I would feel that was an insult.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I trust you. You tell me there's a Geronimo. I'm going to go along with there's a Geronimo.
He expects some level of respect in terms of, if this is the information you give me, I expect it to be authentic. Because he is doing the same for Quill. So far, everything that we've seen, I think, I mean, I want to knock on wood on that one. He is absolutely playing games in the big scheme of things, but he seems to be being straight with Quail all the time.
Quail was the order giver, whereas Broussard was the order taker. He was the one standing between drones and what they were doing. Quail wasn't. So if you're in that situation, I bet you need to trust everything that person tells you.
Yeah, exactly, because you're the one on the line there.
Yeah, so...
And you're the one pulling the trigger. Like, you have to believe that the person is telling you, this other person deserves to die, and I have good reason for it, and you need to trust me. Because he is the one who has to live with that.
We know from earlier, since we're omniscient in this case, the Quail is gone to Will. However, Broussard doesn't know this yet, and Quail keeps up the act. I am the cell boss. What are we meeting for? And Broussard brings in the information from his meeting with the British guy that another cell would like to coordinate with them to have this gigantic takedown, and they kind of need their go-ahead, their blessing, whatever. And playing his part, Quail's like, I'll take a look at it. Yeah, sure. Will's had an interesting day, and he comes home to find a highly dressed-up Katie getting dinner ready.
This looked crazy to Paul, because he doesn't really know what it looks like to have a wife making dinner.
And this one's got mascara on, and kind of a fancy top with the shoulders cut out and stuff.
It's called cold shoulders, Paul. Woo-woo.
So this all seemed highly out of place, and she was huffing and puffing around the kitchen.
Well, come on now. Nobody likes to have a disagreement early in the day and then have to go all day. The end of the night, you got to have that moment where you're like, well, I never.
She's still sore about Will unilaterally deciding to reveal Charlie's existence. Yes. Right. Will does not give her what I would consider to be what she was looking for, the satisfaction of a real heartfelt apology. Something more along the lines of, sorry, I'll do better. Having given apologies before in my life, I don't think that one would work.
Not with this wife.
So I would only
Maybe
give...
Maybe your next one will accept that.
I would only give that apology if I didn't care if you took it or not.
Dang, good to know.
Does that seem acceptable at all? I'm sorry, I'll try again better. Or, I'll try better next time.
No way. I'd run after you. It's shabby the way that he treats this situation, because I know he is feeling very betrayed by Katie and this whole thing, but they still have children together and they have Charlie missing, and that's all still very real, no matter who she's working with or what's happening. So to bring Bram and Gracie in on the situation and kind of use them to prove a point to her about we don't keep secrets, and I don't like using kids as pawns in any form or fashion.
How do you feel about using wives? Because that's what he's going to do in a minute.
I don't know what to think. I feel like he feels so betrayed by her, and that she is still so oblivious always to the fact that she's so exposed and everybody knows what you're doing. Like everybody, Jennifer, Phyllis, Bo, Quail, like everybody knows what you're doing everywhere. And it's like embarrassing at this point. If he's willing to kind of use Bram and Gracie as pawns in this, sort of things are starting to get like all bets are off. You know what I mean? I think the old Will would have protected them. The original Will.
This business with her and the Resistance is the single biggest danger to focus on right away. I mean, he's like very goal-oriented, and this is what he's got to fix right now. So he lays a trap. He tells her that the head of Broussard's cell came in today, and he's willing to give up Broussard, knowing that this should put the fear of God into her, and if she's in the Resistance, that she will go and tell Broussard.
I didn't expect any of this to turn out this way. I honestly, at this point, I can only see in the Daily's relationship, if Paul felt like he had all this intel on me, I don't feel like we would have played it out to this point. I'm like 99% positive that I would have been like, what the hell are you doing? Like, instantly. I don't think we would have been so cool at all to have been able to be like, so I got that cell guy and blah, blah, blah. Like, knowing I was manipulating you into doing something. Because here's the thing. Even if at the end of the day, by getting rid of Quail or Broussard or her cell and sort of extracting her from the resistance, even without her consent for that extraction, because basically he just annihilates her cell, so that kind of pushes her out of the resistance. At the same time, it seems like he's being somewhat chivalrous to do that in a way that doesn't embarrass her by not saying, like, I know what you're doing and now I'm going to clean up your mess. He sort of seems like he's riding in and he's like saving her, but kind of without her even knowing it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is he's going to have to take that to the grave, because if it's ever revealed at any point in time that he knew and this was going on this whole time, this is embarrassment and humiliation times a billion for her. He can give her this graceful exit, but it can never, ever, ever come out that he knew. If it was me, I would like vaporize on the spot out of like the sheer amount of embarrassment and just shame and everything that I had been not only played by my entire cell and I did all this, but my husband, like, to my face, was like manipulating me and treating me like a child, that daddy has to come in and fix this and not even tell me. It's all done behind my back that he's fixing it, you know? It would make me feel awful.
Good to know. I'll have to call off that entire charade.
Please do, and get out of my diary.
All right. It is risky because he doesn't think through the idea that not only could she tell Broussard, but maybe she could get wrapped up in the action herself, which is physically dangerous for her. And he either ignores that or just accepts that, which is pretty scary. Either way, Katie does play into his hands. She does leave, ostensibly, to go to work at the Yonk, but she makes a pit stop at the local payphone to call
Boo Boo Construction
and inform them that her porch is falling down. It's coming down, everyone. My porch, my freaking porch.
I love it that we start calling it Boo Boo Construction. I'm going to call it Boo Boo Construction well after Colony's off the air. I'm going to be all like, hey, let's call Boo Boo Construction. Stuff's happening over here.
Bram and the teacher are up on his rooftop with their homemade telescope checking out the moon.
Now, I am so thankful to have you around for times like this, because the whole time I was like this, what are they looking at? What is that? What are they seeing?
It is not very clear what they are seeing, but what we can tell is that there is a fairly regular shape with some straight lines in it where only craters and irregular shapes should be.
Now, that is fascinating thinking, because if you like held me down on the ground and you were like, look at this image, now tell me, how can you know that something's on here it shouldn't be? You could hold me down there for the rest of my life and I don't think I'd ever utter the words, there are straight lines. Like, it's just like not the way my brain works at all.
Well, you're not,
I promise,
in
I'll be
in charge of satellite imagery dissection.
Listen, I'll be an asset in other ways, okay? Will you vouch for me?
Oh, yeah. She's a great negotiator, but not...
I cannot apparently read satellite blurry footage of the moon.
I wouldn't put her on that
duty
at
that.
At all.
Sorry.
They're basically just high-fiving each other over finding something with their telescope. When we go back to the Yonk, the owner of the bar finds an excuse to take the trash out and finds Broussard in the alley waiting for her. She tells him, Quail has sold us out. Broussard's all like, nah, you're being manipulated, yo.
He goes, I think emotions are clouding your judgment. I'm like, okay, well, it is her husband, whatever. But then she goes, maybe I could say the same thing about you.
So that introduces a question mark, because this guy has been... The stony
opposite day
at best
of emotional. So who is guiding his emotions that he would let anything be clouding? I'm confused. We did learn some information later in this episode that it turns out that Quail and Broussard had worked together in the past. I'm still uncertain here. Are we supposed to think that his emotions are wrapped up in Quail?
I am, yeah, that's where I'm going, that he has some personal allegiance to Quail.
Now, I know that they say something about that a operation went wrong or something, and that's where Quayle no longer worked for the CIA. So I'm wondering if he did something that sacrificed his job in order to save Broussard, or did something that maybe was not the best for the overall group, but it did save Broussard.
That's a fair guess.
So that's my best thing. I mean, that's my only, I put emotional attachment to Q, question mark.
Broussard says Quayle would never sell out. Katie says, I'm not loyal to Quayle. I am loyal to you.
Another like,
Right. It does why
are you so loyal to this man? What did he do? What did you two do?
So Quayle and Broussard are not done having secret meetings. I was kind of curious about what the time frame is. Because is it the
this
same
night?
This night
is so long. I know.
They're like, got to go back and have another chat.
And they don't have like phones or anything. So it's like, would you be like just hunkered down to go to bed? And it's like, yeah, dog it. Like you put up like the Batman light and then
some sort of light signal
or
something.
You have to be like, I got to go meet again. Eh. You know, Quayle's like, I already took my bra off. I'm not going out again.
Broussard is direct. He says, are you talking to the occupation? And Quayle uses the case that he's been building to build a suspicion in Broussard's mind that Katie is a double agent to say, no, I haven't been talking to the occupation.
So he actually refers to it as maybe Katie is running a long con, which is 100% a lost Easter egg for us. The Long Con was the name of the episode that Josh Holloway was featured in as Sawyer. And being a con man in The Long Con generally was pretty much like, if you only could use like two words to describe Sawyer, you could be like Long Con.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
So that was pretty awesome.
Quayle continues to play his part as the cell leader and directs Broussard to give the go-ahead for the British guy's operation. And that in order for Broussard to continue, he needs to cut off all ties with Katie Bowman. No more talking to her. No more seeing her at work. No more winking at her in the parking lot.
No more scrapbooking.
No more scrapbooking. No more bunko. Right. Can't play at recess with her.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Mm-mm. No more cootie catchers.
So Broussard's all like, yeah. And then he leaves.
He's like, I'm grounded from Katie.
I wonder if this is the next day or not, because we are back in the teacher's apartment. The teacher offers him a drink.
Now, this was so awkward because earlier when we had first met the teacher and Bram having their first interaction, he's like, oh, Bram, good. Come in. Close the door. And I was like, ooh, that just comes off creepy. Now we have this next interaction. He's all, hey, do you want a drink? And he clearly pours him something out of like a mason jar that looks 100% like moonshine. I understand that they felt like they needed to have someone who was a little older than Bram for him to have some access to other things and hopefully bring in some amount of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
I do not get why they just didn't choose someone who maybe Bram was in high school with. Maybe they played athletics or something or...
Why
whatever.
Had to go with this youngish teacher?
Well, that could have been like 19 years old, 20 years old. Maybe he was an astronomy student at the college or something. And he, you know, he knew Bram from the neighborhood or whatever. Because things like those two guys who I just described, a 19-year-old college student and a 15, 16-year-old kid having a moonshine drink and discussing what could this be and what could we do? I'm like, for some reason, not eked out by that.
It's definitely inappropriate that a teacher, even after aliens invade, that a teacher would invite a student into their home for...
And give them any kind of alcohol.
Yeah, libations.
Yeah. I mean, and who knows? Maybe it's just water. I don't know why he's keeping it in mason jars or what have you with lids on it. I don't know what exactly that is. But it just came off a little weird, right? And I also would have felt better about Bram having like a buddy, like a guy pal that was going to help fix this, because over the next couple of years, all that's going to happen is Bram's going to age. And I would feel better if he had kind of a, you know, a Daryl to his Rick Grimes, you know, if he had a little, there was something he could be his Beau to his Will, whatever. Like, I wish he had a buddy like that instead of this teacher student semi inappropriate feeling.
I don't
weird.
Think this teacher has much of a future.
I feel you.
In the world of Colony, I think he's going to get found out. And
yeah, that telescope is kind of a big old.
He doesn't have, you know, long term co-star written on his.
You're right.
Forehead.
You're totally right. So Bram says, "Hey, Teach, I got some info. Turns out my brother Charlie's alive."
And Teach is like, "Whoa. You know what I've been thinking about? The moon base."
Now tell me that that wouldn't have been a better conversation with college friend Brad and Bram than teacher Bob and Bram.
I was surprised how dismissive he was.
Because he's an adult and he might have been like, "Wow, what are your parents planning on doing? How do you feel?"
It's not like he changes the subject to something less dangerous, you know?
No.
They're still talking about stuff they shouldn't be talking about. So it was highly selfish of this teacher.
I'm like, as if he has zero training dealing with teenagers too. He's like, "Wow, that sounds like a sensitive subject. Let's talk about me now."
And they chat about the moon base, and that does get Bram re-centered on what the teacher would like to talk about.
So they come up with some thoughts that, you know, there's actually that what we're thinking is like an observatory.
Well, the teacher knows about the observatory, but he doesn't know that it's possible to get there. So I think he just wrote it off like, "Well, I'm only thinking about things inside my little walls here." Bram doesn't have such a closed mind. Will is driving Proxy Snyder to the meeting place.
So we can finally get his face-to-face with Quail. When they pull up, they're like sitting there, right? And it was so crazy because he's like, "Why are we just sitting here?" And Will's like, "Because Quail's waiting and to make sure we don't have him set up." And he's like, "Well, what if we're being set up?" Will's like, "Maybe we are. Like, you're the one that wanted to do this. This is a terrible idea."
But they only see one man standing in the entryway of what is called a Greek theater, where they get outside the Super Cadillac and go to meet him. After some questioning about why he would want to leave the block, what gets delivered is a highly hidden fact.
It appears, at least, that he really wished that this info did not come out.
Because Quail asks for what he calls a transit pass.
So when he was talking with Will and they were talking about getting outside the wall, Will said, "What are you going to do outside the wall?" And he said, "There's groups of people who live out there and the raps just leave them alone." And he very much presented it like he was just going to become this hobo gypsy guy just kind of wandering around out in the outskirts of the civilization, right? And Will was kind of okay with that. But this time when Quail talks to Snyder, he discussed it as a transit pass. Like, it's very official. Not as if he's going to go become this hobo, but because he's going to have this transit pass that's going to allow him to go in and outside of the wall unquestioned. That, my friend, is a totally different request. And Will's looking at Snyder, and Snyder's looking at Will like, I feel like Snyder is like, "Oh, crap, I didn't want Will to know there was such a pass as the transit pass, because I'm trying to make it out to be a big deal to be able to go outside a wall, and that certainly nobody has a pass that allows them to come and go freely. That really undermines why we can't go just walk out and get Charlie."
This is a big deal. Snyder looks away as it's being described, like, "Oh, shit." And the way it's described makes it sound like Snyder couldn't accomplish this pass all by himself. He would need someone above his pay grades say so before it could happen, but not an impossible thing, just sort of like do the right paperwork and then you would get the pass.
I don't know if that's the look he gave or if he, whether it's the something that's above his pay grade. It's like 100% worse if it's not, because if it's not above his pay grade and he doesn't behave like that, then again, you have Will staring at you.
Well, Quail says something to the effect of block governors can't hand them out or something to that effect.
So how was he supposed to get it?
It was his problem. But he does agree to it. So for the deal, he sticks by his word as far as Will's concerned. He doesn't mention Katie, and he says that in exchange for this pass and this truck, that he will give up Broussard plus what he calls bonus prizes.
Only Quail would call humans bonus prizes, right?
The next scene is what is supposed to be Broussard's takedown. It takes place at a street market that is walled in on two sides and is very long and narrow, sort of like a canyon. And with little kiosks and umbrellas all throughout, making it super busy inside.
But with basically just like one entrance and one exit. So which this should be a very ideal situation for capturing somebody.
Broussard and Rachel are seen kind of stalking around, and we see Quail also. No one has really zeroed in on each other just yet. Will's team is using video surveillance to keep track of everything, but Broussard also has Katie stashed away on an upper level where she can see what's going on, and she has a radio to tell him that from her vantage point, she can all of a sudden see some red hats poking up from the roofline across the way from her. She signals him, throws out some lit firecrackers, and things all of a sudden go nuts.
It turns out that La Garza was supposed to be at the exit area. We see Broussard wail out, and we see, I don't remember if it was Broussard or Rachel, glance back, and they see Quail get quickly surrounded by a little handler team to quickly get him to safety.
They say, protect the asset.
And then right at that moment, La Garza steps out long after Broussard's made it away from him. But now Rachel, because she did have some amount of contact with Broussard in that thing, he says something like, Rachel, get out of here, or something like that. I mean, that means basically, okay, you're an accomplice here.
You're made.
Were you shocked when La Garza just not only just shoots her in the chest, but then
takes her out
right in the head?
Yes.
I was like, oh man. I don't know what in the world. That was so wild. I do have to say, La Garza is suspiciously not where he's supposed to be at the right time. He has had two scenarios now where, had he just been closer to the action quicker, he would have had Broussard. So we questioned the previous episodes, why was he 25 minutes away from Snyder when he was supposed to be right with Snyder the whole time? And now this time, wow, how perfect Broussard had the timing to be able to get all the way away before La Garza simply stepped out of a doorway.
Yeah.
They had surveillance cameras and everything. I mean, they could see.
And they know what Broussard looks like.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how this happened, and I'm really wondering about La Garza now.
I think so is Proxy Snyder. They have an after-action review at the Red Hat headquarters, and Proxy Snyder is not happy. Will and La Garza kind of take turns pointing at each other's groups as the source of the problem, and Jennifer steps forward looking for a shiny gold star from the boss because she has an entire file on Quail's history. This could not be worse news for Will. Will had been handling the flow of information to Proxy Snyder concerning Quail's identity, and he had told the story that he was a low-level operative. Turns out, Quail had been a CIA chief in Berlin at one point. If you make the connection there, that is a city that at one time featured a giant wall running through it.
And was featured in World War II.
Pivotal in World War II. And this is the icing on the cake. He had been Broussard's boss back in some action in Beirut until something went wrong there and ended his career.
So that clearly establishes that there's no way that Quail was working for Broussard in this new cell.
No, Snyder sniffs it out and says, there's no way, this guy's low level. This is a much bigger deal. The deal with this guy that we had is off, and Will senses that things are going to go bad for Quail. And if Quail comes in for questioning...
Oh, the second that anyone pokes their finger in Quail's chest, he's going to go like a baby doll, like, Katie! As soon as you push his chest, he's just going to say it like, Mama! He's going to go, Katie!
So rather than wait for anyone else to offer to go and get Quail... Will's like, me and Bo will do it. Let's go, Bo. And so they head out while La Garza and Jennifer, two unlikely compatriots, exchange skeptical glances like, what are these two doing on prisoner transport?
Exactly. Quail had been stashed at a safe house.
Bo and Will pull up outside and exchange notes. Because this is going to get dicey. They know it. And Bo wants to know what he's signed up for, basically.
They had already had their taco talk. And so Bo knew that Will was trying to protect. You know, he didn't say Katie. It could be Bram. He didn't really say. But he knows that Quail has information and could easily divulge who it was, someone that Will wanted to protect. And Bo was in to help with that.
It's interesting the way Bo puts it when he says, we wouldn't want someone who served our country to suffer through torture or something along those lines. And Will can go along with that rationale, sort of like, whatever you need to tell yourself, Bo, I'm glad you're there.
Well, and I think, too, though, it was also Bo's way of putting his hand on Will's shoulder and saying, do what you have to do, and I will back you.
Will goes in, start dealing with Quail.
Gosh, dog it, Quail. You know what? These men need to have a little side discussion about hot talk and, like, when to use it and when it's dangerous.
Crucial conversations class.
Exactly. Because this is a crucial conversation, and the last thing you want to do is when Will comes in, start flapping your gums like a little Muppet.
Quail tries to convince Will that he can just disappear. He could live in Will's own house and he wouldn't even know it for months.
Primarily because you've married a woman who is so full of deceit. She's got these skills in spades. She can just lie and lie and lie and lie.
Yes, after learning all of these things that Quail says that he knows about Katie, Will has had enough of hearing about how she has a talent for deception and that he really, what did he say? He looks up to her or appreciates her or...
Because she's such a liar. I mean, basically, look, here in the South, there's two people you really can't mess with. You can't mess with the guy's mama and you can't mess with his wife. And we don't know jack about Will's mama. So we're going to say that this guy mouthing off about Katie is just enough. Enough. So
even if escape into the night had ever been on the table, Quail's mouth erases it firmly.
Well, you're a husband. How would you feel if you came up and you're talking to somebody, some suspect that you're dealing with, and they're like, oh, your wife's probably so...
I'd feel a lot less inclined to do him any favors the more that he talked. Will agrees with me, pulls out his piece, shoots him 3 times in the chest. Pop, pop, pop. The Red Hat guards are like, what's going on? And they come around the corner and for they their have, trouble... You know what?
They have timing of La Garza. That's what they have.
Maybe they must were be, trained by the
They
big
must
guy.
Be trained by La Garza. La Garza's like, look... Whenever there's a crucial moment, here's what you do. You feel that sense that you should run in, count to 10, and then go in.
So they come around the corner, and for the trouble, Will takes both of them out as well.
Now, we see several potential issues here. Several. Well, now we have dead Red Hats who have body cameras. Broussard showed us in previous episodes that they have cameras on their hats. So,
I gotta know, like, what is the plan here? We haven't seen a lot of police procedural investigative qualities in this show so far. So
like, definitely there's not a ballistics department.
Right. That's just been shut down. They don't even bother with that.
We don't have time to figure out who did what to who now.
No. But it does make sense that if they're going to go through the trouble of having these cameras, that they're going to be...
What's the point of them if nobody goes and looks?
And not that they would even be stored on the device. Like, they would just be... beamed like back uploaded, to right. Red Hat HQ on the fly. So that's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Well, and also Will, Bo, and Jennifer are the high-end investigators in this block. So it's kind of like making a murderer, and it's like police would have to be investigating the police in this case.
Fat chance. So right. Bo comes in, sees the destruction. He's like, so now what?
Poor Bo. He's like, I am never going to get a taco again with you.
Bo takes the reins back at the office while they're delivering the news to Proxy Snyder.
Now, why do you think that they handled it that way? Why would Bo come in and tell this story? I mean, Bo hasn't come in and been the lead on anything. And Will is playing the part of Phyllis these days. So why would Bo come in and be like, I have something to say? If I was Snyder, I'd be like, Bo, you're talking? I'm already suspicious. Like, I never talk to you.
That's a good point, because I was thinking, since Bo doesn't have a specific dog/wife in the fight, he would kind of throw him off the scent.
Like, it would come off more real if Bo was like, hey, I have something to tell you. But like I said, the only trouble is we have zero precedent. I mean, I would bother to watch the show again to find out if Bo and Snyder have even said one sentence to one another up until this point, because I'm willing to put my $2 on the table that Bo has not said boo to Snyder, And now he's the one that comes in to say the report and Will has to stay in there?
That is suspicious because Will is the one that brought this whole deal to Snyder. So it does seem like his business to follow up on it.
Absolutely. And he's like the commanding person of these two, I think.
Proxy Snyder smells a rat right away.
Immediately. He's like, I see gun residue on your finger. Is that right, the word? Gun residue?
Gunpowder residue.
Bullet residue. What's the words? Powder? There's some sort of black marks on your hand.
Wash your hands.
Wash your hand. You're disgusting.
he kind of loses it. He's up against the wall here. He's got this performance review in a short amount of time. He almost had the keys to the resistance here, and his top flight guys kind of screwed it up for him. So he gets very angry with specifically Will. But since
what do you think about Snyder angry? We haven't really seen him angry.
Well, I think he could.
Because he kind of stayed cool even in the Geronimo trial. He was just like, this is how it has to be, people. Like, he never got angry. He never got mad.
Well, this was a pretty angry guy. And he was willing at that point to say and maybe even do anything to make his point.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't pull like a Housewives and flip a table. Be like, listen to me, NeNe Leakes.
It was a little more like. It was not exactly, but a little more like in Game of Thrones when Joffrey would just say, kill them all, and his guards would just start killing people. It wasn't quite to that level, but it was approaching that level.
I feel terrible for Snyder just from the standpoint of, like, he seemed to be genuine in his desire to keep everything as good for everybody as he could for as long as he could. And I just feel like it's like the sand is coming through his fingers right now and just he can't get a grip on anything. And now his main guy who's been doing a good job of like identifying Broussard and of getting the bomber and doing all these things. And then now it's just like they can't seem to close any deals anymore and just it's falling apart.
Especially if you felt like he honestly seems to feel that he is doing right by his populace better than anybody else ever in the world. Not in any kind of selfish way either. That he is giving them the best life that they could ever hope for under the current regime.
Well, I'm
and
sorry.
To be getting shat on time and time again.
If your boss says, which I'm going to call Helena the boss of him, if your boss says the boot stamping line to you and you have been trying to just keep the peace through kindness and recreation and that type of thing, then good God, when somebody does this, you want to be like, go get the boot, stamp some faces.
Snyder might be seeing some logic in that argument because he says it was a mistake to give you this much latitude. He doesn't give anything specific, but he does seem to indicate that the next time they meet, he will be giving them some change in their relationship and the way things are going to be going down from then on.
Scary for Will and Bo.
Will and Bo drive off in the middle of nowhere and compare notes over a drink. Will says he had to kill them, that he couldn't trust that Quail wasn't going to spill his beans, and these beans were too valuable to him to leave up to chance, so that's what had to happen.
That's what hot talk will get you every time.
Bo understands the logic, but he is unsure how long the lie will hold up. And if these body cams are of any value to anyone ever.
Yeah, why would you ever need them if it wasn't for a situation like this?
Yeah, right. So, yeah, Bo is on to something. Next scene is very sad. It takes place under this overhang, like a overhead walkway, I think it is. There are three bodies being hung by chains. As Katie approaches, she can make out clearly that it's Rachel and her sons strung up with signs around their necks reading terrorist. She gets all weepy, and Broussard approaches her and informs her that he's got to go into hiding, but he's going to come back, and that when he does, he wants her to stand with him. Because this display, what they're standing under right now, is exactly what they're fighting against. He needs her, but he needs her to wait for him.
the imagery of those bodies hanging down from the bridge, it resonated with me. I remembered something similar, having seen something on the news. We live in Texas, and so we're very close to the Mexican border. And just a couple years ago, there was an incident where there were the bodies of many people were hung over the side of the bridge, meant to warn people of basically like a turf war situation right across the border from Laredo, Texas. It looks so familiar with Rachel that, and all that, and the boys hanging there, that it made me think of that image. And I'll post it on our Daily Review Facebook page, and it is graphic, but you, as soon as you see it, you'll be like, oh my gosh, that's just what it looked like. It is something that is used as, you know, fear and...
Scare tactic.
No, I mean, scare tactic seems like not harsh enough, but I mean, obviously it sends a message, and it's like the horse head in the bed, right? I mean, it's bad news.
We have our final meeting between Katie and Will for the episode back at their house. Katie is again at the stove, and Will walks in after a long day of being yelled at and says, are we still fighting? And Katie says, are you tell me. Instead of making up, Will gives her perhaps too subtle of a way out of trouble, a pass, if you will. He tells her that the cell leader is now dead and that she has nothing to worry about. To me, this is a way of saying your cell is dead. As long as you don't keep screwing around with the resistance, no one is going to know that you were in and we can be safe now. So it's up to you to take me up on it, dear. But I don't know if that's too much left unsaid to be understood. Do you think Katie will take him up on his unspoken offer?
No. I think that we have more than underscored the idea that what Katie doesn't know. And so, unfortunately, I think that his subtlety and his way that he's trying to, I think, be like graciously getting her out of trouble. Like, it's like if you know your kid got into some sort of trouble and you go behind their back to the teacher or whatever and you fix the problem, and then suddenly he has an A and nobody ever says anything. Nobody ever reprimands a kid. Then the kid didn't exactly learn any lesson, did he?
No.
No, quite the opposite. He might be emboldened to think that he got away with this, that he got out unscathed. And so usually when that kind of thing happens with a kid, they usually amp it up. They usually take it to the next level and do something even more ridiculous. As much as I appreciate that Will is trying, what is it that he's trying to do? Why doesn't he just say, I know what you're doing and stop?
Maybe it's what you already said, that it'd be too humiliating for him to be like, I've known for weeks, everyone in the department has been telling me so.
All he would have had to say is, when we were dealing with Quail, he told me privately that you were involved. I know you were involved, so you need to stop. This is a way out.
It does seem simpler to do it that way.
Well, I don't know. Unless there's a layer here, again, that is more sophisticated than the way that you and I deal with each other. Because you and I are very... We're very blunt with one another. I mean, if we're like...
You, stop it.
Basically, we're like, I don't like that. You know, like, we don't need safe words. We say, stop. Like, you know what my safe word is? Don't do that again. Maybe this is why Katie is so naive behaving. Maybe he does keep so much from her and fixes things. Maybe he has fixed things their whole marriage that she doesn't realize that she, you know, ran over a dog. He like goes and gets a new dog that looks the same as that dog and puts it in its place and is like, look, honey, you didn't hit the dog after all, and like buries the dead one. I don't know. Like, maybe he does this. Maybe he's going around fixing problems for her, and that's led her to believe that nothing bad ever happens and I don't ever have to look twice or think about what I'm doing, because the plan, maybe from her perspective, always works out. This is the whole premise of the whole show. If on the first day Will said, get out of the resistance, this would be a whole different show. Or if she had successfully hidden it this whole time. But this is a show about a husband knowing something about his wife and manipulating every bit of her environment and her life, the people she talks to, and going behind her back and doing all these things. How is it any different than Don Draper calling the psychiatrist after and saying, what'd she talk about? Like, how is it any different? And that was like, everybody went like this when he called the psychiatrist and he blabbed the whole thing. How is it any different? You know? Mm. And so then in that case, it's like, oh, whoa, back up the bus here. That feels a little different to me. Maybe Katie, like Betty, is not naive, but has been daddied by her husband in a pretty major way, and maybe isn't totally aware of the consequences of some of the stuff she's doing. It would be a whole fresh look for me on Katie, and it would be a whole fresh look for me on their relationship and this dynamic. And is it chivalrous to come in and clean up her mistakes, or is it controlling to come in and clean up her mistakes, or what you perceive to be her mistakes? Because again, it's not as though he thinks that they should all live under the host's rules and that this should be their life. It's not like he's given in to this. He would like this to be over too. So then it's like, she's not exactly like out there, you know, causing trouble. You know what I'm saying?
For such an action-oriented show, to have our hero be this overly complicated, sometimes control freak, sometimes too big-hearted for his own good kind of guy, I don't know, doesn't jive with me. Doesn't feel right.
Okay, what doesn't feel right?
That he'd be trying to control the situation out of just some sense of needing to be in control of her. That doesn't fit. That doesn't feel right to me.
But here's what I have to say about that. Every time that we've seen Will in action, we've seen people standing around him saying, why would you do it like that? Like Bo saying, why don't we sit here and observe? Why do you have to run in there? Why do you have to be so pushy? Why do you have to go in there and grab this guy today? Why don't you just sit back and chill a little bit? Why? Because he's very driven when it comes to certain parts of his life. And I'm suggesting he may just be very driven. Now, I'm not saying this is evil. I'm sure he perceives it as safety for his wife. However, I just read a story about a father in New York City who locked his family, his six children and his wife, every single day. And they stayed in an apartment for, it was like 15 years. They never were allowed outside. He would lock the door every day and say, don't come out. The world's a scary place. That was a real story. And now they called themselves the Wolf Pack, the children did. And they are now making a movie about them. But the point is that he wasn't doing it out of malice. He felt like the world was too scary and it was too much.
Again, though, Will doesn't, he's not presenting as crazy either. He seems like a guy between a rock and a hard place. He's having to bend quite a bit from what he would really prefer to be doing with his life.
Then why doesn't he just talk to her? We've seen them just laying there in bed. We've seen, you know, we've seen times. We've seen them sitting out drinking their wine, talking in the backyard at least two or three times. And here's the thing. Why? Because it's a good show for them to not have it be straightforward. Totally understandable. But not unlike Don Draper, what made for a good TV and what made for a good man, two different things.
True. But again, we just don't have that level of characterization in this show. For me, it would just feel so out of place that he would be this overly complex guy.
How could he be simple at this point? How could you think he's simple? The whole premise of the show is based on the complexity of how he's handling this.
He's having to balance a few things simultaneously, but he acts pretty consistently throughout. I mean,
let me ask you this.
That's why Don was such an enigma, was that he would have these moments of brilliance and then moments of stupidity and moments of...
Okay, let me ask you this. Why didn't he just kill Quail when they first met up?
I don't think he's a psychopath and just wants to kill people to kill people.
But he knew right then that he knew about Katie.
But he also thought that he could get Quail gone.
Why would he leave him out there for him to write letters, make other phone calls, whatever? If I was Quail, the first thing I would do is write something and mail it. Isn't that usually what happens in these scenarios? Because he has...
Upon my death.
Or if I die, Will Bowman killed me. So it's really wild that Will left him out there in the world, knowing that if he spilled the beans, Not only would Katie go to the factory, but so would Gracie and Bram and him. Wow, that was a really major choice.
The follow through with...
Like we just, like the show's just going to drop it. Quail's not going to have breathed a word to anybody.
It would be probably make more sense if he did. Yeah, it'd breathe some kind of life into some of those areas in the show that are a little lacking. The believability of the follow through of certain entities / people. The thoroughness of the aliens' technology for keeping a populace under control seems pretty iffy at this point, given what they've displayed that they can do.
Well, it's weird. Like, we have the idea that they're listening on the phones.
We have no proof of that yet, though.
You're right, but they use all that code talk.
Yeah.
Right? And so then if they use all that code talk, but then there's, like, no concern that this guy just called my office and said this over the phone lines.
Right.
Like, why wouldn't he go and kill him just for that? Like, you called me at my work and said something about my wife that I actually know is true. I already knew it was true. My previous boss, my coworker, have already told me that. Why don't I kill you just because of that? Because you're kind of blackmailing me. So I should just kill you for that. Dangerous game. Will's an interesting character. I don't know what to make of him at this point. I honestly don't. Because I really don't get why he would keep a blackmailer around. And I don't get why he would trust a blackmailer.
He might not trust the next one.
The next Quail better watch it.
There might be a next one.
The next one's going to be called the Swan. Get it? Like another bird, but a Lost reference?
Maybe.
Shut up. Well, you guys, I apologize very much for this being a late podcast. My throat voice has been giving me a lot of trouble this last week, and I really appreciate you guys being patient and waiting for the sassier half of the Daily Review to get my voice back.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.